This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Back in the 19th century, Philadelphia was known as the workshop of the world because it was an energy hub for coal that came in on rail lines from the mines in rural parts of the state. Today, some influential people in the city and region are saying that natural gas from the Marcellus Shale could make the city the workshop of the world again. It would mean upgrading and expanding the pipelines that already snake through our region, bringing natural gas to processing plants on the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers. There are concerns and questions, though, about the environmental impact of such an ambitious plan on the region. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio, including Patrick Kirkstra. He's a writer, blogger, and deputy editor for Philadelphia Magazine. And what got us talking about this on Radio Times is his story in this October issue of Philadelphia Magazine titled Philadelphia Plus a Pipeline or Two Equals America's Next Energy Hub. Patrick Kirkstra, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Mark Allen Hughes. He's a professor of practice at Penn Design, also faculty director of the Kleinman Center on for Energy Policy. At the University of Pennsylvania. He was the chief policy advisor to Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter and the founding director of sustainability for the city of Philadelphia, where he led the creation of the Greenworks Plan. And Mark Allen Hughes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Patrick, let me begin with this guy, Phil Rinaldi. He's sort of stars in the piece that you wrote in Philadelphia Magazine. He's really the guy with the vision behind this vision for Philadelphia.
Yeah, he is. Phil Rinaldi is the CEO of Philadelphia Energy Solutions, and this is the company that came in a few years back to buy the South Philadelphia refinery long run by Sunoco that was on the verge of closing because of the really difficult economics of refining. PES and Phil have invested a lot into the refinery. They've turned it around financially. It's making significant money again. But more than that, he's really pushing an incredibly ambitious, broad, sweeping vision for a totally reworked Philadelphia manufacturing economy built not just on oil, but on natural gas.
And all the things that natural gas can make, for instance, petrochemical plants, all things like that.
Yeah, natural gas, obviously we can burn it, and that provides power and heat. But you can also do a lot of other things with natural gas. You can use it to make plastics. You can use it to make industrial chemicals. And, you know, from those sort of basic products, you can make a lot of other products. You can make a lot of stuff out of plastics. You can make a lot of stuff out of these industrial chemicals. You can make a lot of stuff cheaply with the energy that, burned natural gas provides.
What do you think of this plan, Mark Allen Hughes, broadly speaking?
Well, broadly speaking, it certainly captured the imagination. I think, and Patrick has so nicely framed for really the region many aspects of this conversation. I think that kind of in the broadest possible terms, the question is not so much yes or no, should we or shouldn't we, but really it's under what conditions, and those conditions include at what cost and who pays. So I think there's lots to talk about on this, but the vision itself is super compelling. That I think for probably at least 50 years, Philadelphia and the region have been looking for a logic, looking for a role to play in the larger economy of the state, mm-hmm. the country, and the world. And I think this is as good a narrative as we've had for a couple of generations.
But does it mean that Marcellus Shale and fracking, which happens in other parts of the state, doesn't really happen in the Philadelphia area, that Patrick, in a sense, is coming to Philadelphia, Marcellus Shale?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the most complicated and interesting economic stories in Pennsylvania in recent years has been the Marcellus boom. But its impact on Philadelphia until now has been kind of negligible. The drill pads are closest 105 miles away. It's been incredibly controversial and created a lot of jobs, but in Philadelphia it hasn't meant a lot. This vision that Rinaldi and a lot of other folks are embracing, if pipelines were built and Philadelphia could tap into the reserves in the Marcellus Shale, which are truly enormous, and that's something we should talk about at some point.
Yes.
Then Philadelphia would finally be impacted in ways great and potentially awful by the Marcellus Shale boom.
Well, let me go back to you, Mark, because, if this vision pans out, it could mean jobs. It could be well-paying jobs. It could be reviving industries or bringing new industries to the region. But you can't ignore the environmental impacts or the potential for environmental impacts, including the fact that if you have chemical plants in the area and something happens, there are millions of people that live in the Philadelphia area. How do we factor that in?
That's right. I think, again, speaking very generally at first, the way we factor that in is we have to build a capacity. Some of it's going to be in government, but probably government's, and really it's too big for government alone. We have to build a capacity to talk our way through these issues, because there's no, as much science as there is that we can kind of talk through around this, the science alone is not going to resolve. These aren't puzzles to figure out. These mm-hmm. are decisions to be made. And some of the decisions include who's going to bear the costs or even the risks of some of those impacts. So let's talk a little bit about kind of and the impacts have different scales, right? Patrick's already talked about one of the interesting things about this is the way it connects different parts of the state, right? The upstate where the source of the extraction is, potentially us, where the benefits of much of that extraction could be realized through manufacturing, mm-hmm. and then the connection between them with right. infrastructure investments and so on. There's also actually Fred Krupp at EDF has got an interesting analogy.
The Environmental Defense Fund, yes.
The Environmental Defense Fund. We talk about how natural gas can be a bridge, right? A bridge to renewable and cleaner sources of energy. But he actually he tightens that analogy up a little bit. He says it needs to be an off-ramp, right?
Meaning?
It needs to help us move away more quickly than we could otherwise from a reliance on all of the impacts that fossil fuels in general, not just natural gas, can have. And so what natural gas can help us do, and that's why I love the phrase energy hub rather than natural gas hub, because there are many different forms of energy that are potentially in play here, many sources of jobs, just to take one, energy efficiency or something, right? So there's lots of ways to make money related to energy in Philadelphia that would exploit our closeness to market, our need for employment, and so on. So there are a number of impacts, and then they've become more and more local, like the kinds of things that we would recognize more quickly as pollution, right? There can be water pollution and air pollution closer to the source and so on.
Well, let me go back to Patrick, and even going back to the how this gas is pipelined around the state, frankly, around the country, it really is breathtaking. We focus so much on the Keystone, the potential of the Keystone pipeline, but there are hundreds of thousands of miles, it seems, of pipeline that already exists.
Yeah, when you pull up a map and really start to look at it, it's kind of staggering. I found one not far from my house, a hazardous liquids pipeline, which is refined materials, basically. And these things, these pipelines, many of which are very old, have...
Like decades and decades old, right?
Yeah, 100 years or more in some right. cases, that are still in use. They go through heavily populated areas. They go through rural areas largely, but they're kind of ubiquitous, which is not something that you think about, given the controversy that reliably erupts anytime a new pipeline proposal is made.
Well, in fact, part of this vision is that, or perhaps it's already happening, is that the natural gas comes into Philadelphia. Then it gets piped down 1,400 miles to Louisiana. You went to this place called Henry Hub. I guess, refined, and then sent back up. I mean, talk about an inefficient way to get our energy.
Right. Well, I mean, the natural gas pipeline infrastructure that we have today, was built to serve the natural gas reserves that we've had in the past. And those were concentrated in the South and in around the Gulf Coast in particular. And that's also where a lot of the processing capability for natural gas is. That's where the petrochemical companies are located. That's where a lot of the demand is. And so, yeah, I mean, the pipeline infrastructure was that we have now is built to like flow material up from the Gulf Coast to, homes and businesses in the Northeast and really around the country. And so, because the Marcellus is far and away the largest reserve in the country now, what we're taking out of the Marcellus, a lot of it is going all the way down to Henry Hub in Texas in Louisiana before it gets pumped back out across the country.
And is the vision to sort of keep it in there, do all the refining and everything here rather than sending it 1,400 miles away and then 1,400 miles back?
Exactly. I mean, the vision is, you're 100 miles away from the biggest gas reserve in the nation. You have infrastructure in place in form of a port, rail, a population that's accustomed to manufacturing in the past, and you bring all that together, and you do the processing here, and you use the process materials to make other things.
Well, and I know you wanted to say something, but I'm sure people listening to us, Mark, are thinking, you know, especially those who oppose Marcellus Shale, they oppose the fracking, they are worried about all the environmental, potential environmental degradations as a result of that. Are you saying, and I think others are saying, but are you saying, look, it's here to stay. We're not going to not be drilling for natural gas, and certainly not in Pennsylvania. So we have to figure out how to do it as best we can.
Actually, I know a lot of people put it exactly that way, and it's always startling to me when they do. It's not necessarily here to stay, right? There are certainly large forces behind the promotion and development of the energy source, and I think there are very strong reasons why we should develop it. But I actually don't like the phrase "it's here to stay." Mm-hmm. And it's really much more about this kind of under what conditions, right? And so it's really on us as a, you know, polity. It's really on us to take seriously those concerns and articulate them and then build the capacity to monitor and to enforce. Again, it's under what conditions? When at the extraction, as we learn more and more about what can, in fact, have local water impacts at the point of extraction, really it appears at this point to be less about the fracking fluids and more about poorly constructed, poorly monitored wellheads themselves. There are many such examples where what we really need to do is act like we mean it when mm-hmm. we say that there are known potential impacts, known potential risks. We need to think about these in terms of liability. We need to post bonds that keep people from being able to get away with those kinds of things.
But, I mean, is it asking industry to, in a sense, regulate and police itself, or does it require government being much stricter about making sure it's as safe as it possibly can be and that companies are responsible if something goes wrong?
It certainly isn't the first where industry can police itself.
There's a long track record there, isn't there?
There's too much to ask, right? But it's probably actually a little bit more than the second. Government alone is unlikely to ever have the capacity, nor frankly would most Americans want to really build a government that could make sure that nothing bad ever happened. That would be too strong a government for us. Instead, there are enforceable partnerships. There are collaborative forms of regulation. Colorado is probably the national leader in working through across those issues because they had a real table that adequately represented all sides that could then actually work through and create a set of rules that industry, government, and the public were comfortable following. Right? So it's got to be a little bit more than just government, but government has to be a piece of it.
And that's Mark Allen Hughes. He's a professor of practice at Penn Design, also faculty director of the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us is Patrick Kirkstra. He's a writer, blogger, and deputy editor for Philadelphia Magazine. And we are talking about a piece he has in this month's edition of Philadelphia Magazine titled "Philadelphia Plus a Pipeline or Two Equals America's Next Energy Hub." We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. What do you think of this idea? Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Doctors are committed to making sure patients stay healthy, but who takes care of the healthcare system as a whole? If you work in public health, you do. And Jefferson School of Population Health can help you to join this growing field with their Master of Public Health program. Register for an information session on October 15th at 5:30 p.m. for classes starting in January by visiting jefferson.edu/pophealthinfosession. Jefferson supports WHYY.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents the U.S. premiere of Carlos Amorales' film The Man Who Did All Things Forbidden, 2014. Carlos Amorales, a contemporary artist whose art explores the culture and values of his native Mexico through a variety of media. A screening of the film will be followed by a Q&A session with the artist, Carlos Amorales, at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Sunday, October 21st at 5:30. Open to the public with limited seating. Details at 215-235-7469 or philamuseum.org.
Haddonfield Friends School supports WHYY, the Fisher-Roseman family from Collingswood, the DeFlumeri family from Philadelphia, the Salam family from Marlton, and families from over 30 towns have chosen Haddonfield Friends School for their child's education. Tuesday tours are available from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. any Tuesday. An open house will be held Sunday, October 19th from 2 to 4 p.m. Details and more information about Haddonfield Friends School and the open house available online at haddonfieldfriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about this question. Could Philadelphia become the next energy boom town in the country? And some influential people envision the city as a thriving energy hub with pipelines from Marcellus Shale, bringing natural gas to processing plants along the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers. Of course, critics include anti-fracking activists and some environmental groups. Nonetheless, it's a conversation certainly worth having, talking with Patrick Kirkstra, and the actual name of his piece in the Philadelphia Magazine, the hard copy, is Pipe Dreams, and Mark Allen Hughes with us as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Patrick, talk a bit about at least the vision for the kinds of jobs that would be created. If this were to become this energy manufacturing hub, what are we talking about?
Well, this is one of the things that's most exciting about this possibility, is that the sorts of jobs that exist in the petrochemical industry and the refining business are exceptionally high-paying, relatively low-skilled jobs. What do we mean by that? That there's a lot of opportunity for folks with high school degrees to go out and earn a high-paying union job. A lot of these guys make in the order of $90,000, $100,000
wow.
a year with overtime.
Wow.
So it's kind of one of those holdover type industries where the labor expense for these businesses isn't the core expense for them. The facilities are billions of dollars. The feedstock, the supply, is very expensive. That's the stuff that's really expensive for them. So they've got the ability, and they traditionally do. And Phil Rinaldi has a great relationship with the labor unions at his shop, and they do very, very well for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And It's opportunity for low-skilled workers. And, you know, as we know, Philadelphia has employment problems kind of across the board, but it's most acute and most problematic, for lower-skilled workers in Philadelphia. Those are the folks who have the least opportunity.
Mark, it's interesting to talk about, natural gas making Philadelphia this workshop of the world again, and 100-some years ago it was coal. I just was on vacation and spent part of my time in Germany, and the thing that just blew my mind, the number of windmills in that country, the number of buildings with solar panels, farms with gigantic solar panel farms. It seemed like, crossing almost every turn and hill, there was another wind farm. We seem to be in love, or some people seem to be in love with natural gas as, the next great thing. But I worry that that's going to push out the idea of renewables.
Well, this is one of the big policy challenges for the natural gas agenda. Natural gas is great when it displaces coal, especially in the production of power, of electricity, because when combusted, when burned, natural gas puts out about half the CO2 levels of coal when it's burned. The problem, of course, which I think we'll probably be talking about a little bit later, is that natural gas before it's burned is methane, and methane is about 86 times more potent a greenhouse gas for the first 20 years of its time in the atmosphere than CO2. So it's really bad when it leaks, but it's not as bad when it burns. But the bigger problem for natural gas in policy terms is that it's great when it displaces coal, but when it displaces energy efficiency, the first fuel, or renewables, solar and wind, it's not as good for both the climate pollution and, other policy goals. And so what the beauty of, when you hear people talk about a carbon tax or a cap and trade or different kinds of ways in which we say, burning carbon isn't really as cheap as it seems. It's actually got lots of hidden costs. Some of them have to do with health. Some of them have to do with climate change and so on. That when we make it as expensive as it really is in full terms, putting a price on carbon is a key to many problems, because that way gas just displaces coal without displacing renewables.
Yeah, go ahead, Patrick.
I think that there's an opportunity cost, not just sort of nationally with an emphasis on gas, but for locally. So say Philly bets big on natural gas and we go full bore and billions of dollars in capital are invested and we're really on top of the world, 4, 10, 20, even 30 years. But because our bandwidth is taken up by this massive endeavor, we're left behind when we do eventually transition to wind, to solar, to other renewables. And, you know, the spoils of the next 50 years go to another metro area. I mean, there's no reason, theoretically, we can't do both, but it's very challenging to do something of this scale and also build up, you know, your alternative energy infrastructure.
Well, just a quick question, and then I'll go to Mark Allen Hughes. But this Phil Rinaldi that you write about in the piece, does he see it that way, or is he just focused on what he sees as the potential in natural gas?
You know, we did not talk about renewables. Okay. I don't know what his view is on that. He's a lifetime fossil fuel guy.
Well, okay. I have to say, a 30 or 40 year time horizon for a private sector guy is actually probably all we're going to ask of him anyway. That's a pretty good. That's pretty good lead time. So the one thing I was going to follow up on Patrick's comment about is that it's true that we'd be making an infrastructure bet, right, especially on the pipelines, but other kinds of investments, they're going to be driven by this strategy as well. That's why fixing the leaks in that system are so important, because it is possible to transition, you know, as a feedstock. The chemical elements of natural gas are 200 times more valuable in the production of plastics and the kinds of things that Patrick was talking about before than they are as a source of electricity generation. The real value in natural gas is as an input into materials and then manufacturing processes that doesn't burn any of it, right? And so that's where the upside is. And so if we can fix the problems of the infrastructure, and it's not just the leaks, it's also the siting and the wildlife habitat, and it's on and on and on. But if we can fix the infrastructure investment, it's possible to move away from the combustion and still get, you know, until the supplies last, other advantages.
Let me get, looks like Lisa from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, so I was listening to the conversation, and particularly talking about jobs. It seems to me investing in the infrastructure for natural gas is so short-sighted because it's a finite resource, and we know renewable is not. So if we invest in renewable energy, we're investing in a very long-term future. The second point has to do with the pipeline to Cove Point. That's an export terminal. So how is it energy independence for America to take gas from Pennsylvania, ruin our land and water, and then send it overseas?
Lisa, you raised several points, and I'm not surprised to hear from Lisa. And there are, I'll go back to you, Patrick. I mean, there are serious concerns about some of the things that can go wrong.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think those are both incredibly valid concerns. Right. I mean, number one is sort of the opportunity cost issue that we've just discussed, and I agree that's a significant risk. Number two is what I think is really sort of the worst case scenario for the region, and that is that instead of using the natural gas to power manufacturing and as a feedstock to create products that can be used here and create a lot of jobs, that instead, you know, the region becomes a glorified export terminal. That's like the worst case scenario, because we absorb all of the risk of these massive petrochemical facilities, and then we don't do anything with what they create, and the job growth is limited, and the you know, environmental and risk up is huge that we take for limited upside.
Well, and I guess the question mark that an article like this raises is, can you have good jobs, good paying jobs, a sustainability, a source of energy, a boon to the economy? I mean, can you have it all built around this idea?
It's difficult, but it's possible if we take that question as seriously as we can. If we addressed and attempted to answer the question that really the caller, Patrick, and you have just posed, the nest of questions, if we took them seriously, we could get pretty close to that sweet spot. But we have to do things like, yes, it's going to be an off-ramp. Yes, we are going to cap. In Pennsylvania, we're going to cap, for example, the lifetime for which we'll be able to burn fossil fuels for electricity generation, right, and in central plants. Now, there are lots of details, right? Micro or residential combined heat and power, CHP, is a huge on-the-cusp technology where people can have small electricity-producing natural gas-fired furnaces, power plants in their houses. It's very close to being ready for market, and it has much more greater efficiency. A central power plant that's burning natural gas is 30 or 40% of the rest of its waste. In a house where you're actually capturing the heat and so on and so on and so on, it's more like 80%,
wow.
Right? And so there are also ways in which we could kind of push the frontier where we have to pivot away from this old school burning fossil fuels. There are ways we can do these things, but they will not happen on their own.
And that's Mark Allen Hughes, who joins us along with Patrick Kirksta. And we've got a lot of callers. I'm very happy to hear that. And that phone number again is 1-888-477-9499. We're also here from our email listeners or our social media listeners. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Michael from Cape May Courthouse to join us. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. You mentioned very clearly that our whole communities here snake with pipelines from old infrastructure and are actively in use transporting dangerous chemicals. Now, that seems to me to be a state issue. And what type of commission and what type of oversight have we had over the past 100 years? So why should we expect that our government should now gain the new religion and take care of the new pipelines? Why not put into place a central omnibus governmental entity who's responsible for inspecting all pipe welds, all junctures, and so forth? Because I would be comfortable if it just wasn't left up to private industry, who is always interested in maximizing profits at the expense of technology. And leave you with this: we've always in the U.S. had a tax policy that allows accelerated depreciation of plant and equipment, but we've never had a tax policy that expects it to be reinvested. Look at Bethlehem Steel. They were running the Japanese.
Well, you know, Michael, let me just jump in here only because I don't want to get too off track. But you raise an important point. And again, we're hearing some pushback, some suspicion. You know, can we trust business? Can we trust government? Can we trust and perhaps there is a need, maybe the EPA. I mean, there are federal government organizations whose job it is to oversee some of this stuff. What are your thoughts, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, the pipelines that cross state lines are federally regulated. You know, there are a lot of people who feel that that regulation is not robust enough. Pipelines that stay within a state are state regulated, and there are probably still more people who feel that the state regulation is not robust enough, and I would tend to agree with that, particularly on the state level. I will say though that you know, the safety risk involved in new pipelines is, I think any fair review shows, fairly negligible. The technology has come a long way. The risk is very limited. The methane leakage is considerably less when you're talking about a new pipeline than an old one. And the real risk, you know, and there have been a small handful of accidents involving old pipelines that are scary, quite scary.
Was it shocking to find a pipeline so near to where you live?
It was a little surprising. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, is it sort of hidden in plain sight?
Sort of. Yes, they are. I mean, they're and if you look around, you'll see them. I mean, there's tree covers is cut up along the pipeline route. There are, you know, flags marking where they are, little banners. You know, take a stroll through Tinicum Reserve, for instance, and you'll see the pipelines everywhere.
And that's Patrick Kirkstra, who joins us along with Mark Allen Hughes. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Patrick, let me go back to you, because in this piece, it seems as if not just replacing old pipelines, but there are calls to create new pipelines, and new pipelines with the thought that in the future, if you build it, you know, these chemical companies will come. Is that a risky proposition?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's sort of two different pipeline projects that we could talk about. One is already underway. Sunoco Logistics is repurposing an existing pipeline to bring natural gas liquids. That's the stuff that you make the high-value chemicals that we've been talking about with. That's underway. They're talking about – that's called Mariner East. They're talking about Mariner East 2, a whole new pipeline that would go right next to it. So you see the boom mentality. You see, I mean, we're not even done repurposing one, and we got plans for another one right next to it, which will – no doubt make neighbors of that pipeline excited. I'm being sarcastic.
I was going to say, he says sarcastically.
he says sarcastically, yes. The other pipeline is the one that Phil Rinaldi is pushing, and it's still very much in a pre-proposal phase, so I should qualify that. But, you know, he's looking to build a large diameter, 42-inch, which is as big as natural gas pipelines get, pipeline directly into Philadelphia from, you know, the gas fields of northeastern Pennsylvania. He's talking about dry gas. That's not the liquids. He's using it to, you know, power an industrial boom. That's the thought. And he can consume a reasonable chunk of the gas at his refinery for uses there. And, you know, he might be looking to build a power plant. He might be looking to make ammonia. He might be looking to do a lot of things with that gas. But he's talking about building capacity way above and beyond anything that he can use himself. And it's an unusual approach to pipeline construction, and it's not certain at all that it'll work. He's trying to induce demand, basically, and that's not the way pipelines tend to get built.
Well, Mark Allen Hughes is a former founding director of sustainability for Philadelphia. How do you sell that? I guess to people, especially who are skeptical, how do you sell Rinaldi's? It's not your job, obviously, but how?
It used to be.
I know, it used to be. Mm-hmm. How do you sell that to people?
Well, I think you have to listen to them, right? You have to accommodate their concerns, and you have to treat those concerns and those fears, regardless of their accuracy or their source, as real, right? And so first you have to listen to constituencies, and then you have to allow constituencies to mobilize, and then you have to construct a decision process that everyone accepts as legitimate and transparent, right? And this is the kind of thing that other places do, and we're not really that good at it and haven't been for quite some time.
Well, yeah. I was thinking that long list of things that, you know, have tried to go through that process.
Yeah, no, that's right. And then, but even beyond, once the kind of the so-called decision is made, you have to stay in the game. Right. You have to, you know, Lincoln Stevens wrote this famous book, right? Shame of the Cities with the Philadelphia chapter. It's called Corrupt and Contented. Everybody knows that part, right? But the best part of that chapter actually says, you know, Philadelphians have this real, they love reform. And the reason why they love reform is because they hate to govern. They all want to go home. They want to reform and then fix it. And I don't have to think about this anymore. But the real challenge is going to be building a way to stay in this game and make sure that these concerns are always addressed. Without that, you know, I'm really happy to see the Chamber of Commerce mobilized around any economic development strategy because they've been not around for as long as any of us can remember. It's terrific that they've got an idea, but that's not going to be enough. Mm. They've got to address the constituencies, some of which are based on fear and concerns of real people in the real world.
And we're almost up on a break here. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, Patrick. And I think it's important to realize that it's all that much harder here because these facilities are located cheek to jowl with the city, with dense suburban neighborhoods. You know, we're not talking about building this, you know, in the middle of rural Butler County, right? That would be challenging enough. But you're talking about doing it because of where these sites are located, you know, in incredibly dense populations. And that makes it much harder.
Well, and we are talking about a city with ports, and that's been one of the benefits, and a rail system and a road system as well. Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Patrick Kirkstra, he's a writer, blogger, deputy editor for Philadelphia Magazine, and his story in this month's edition of Philadelphia Magazine, Pipe Dreams, raises a whole host of questions about whether Philadelphia can be an energy hub. Also with us, Mark Allen Hughes, and he's faculty director of the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. We have Mark Brownstein from the Environmental Defense Fund waiting to join our conversation after this short break. We'll be right back.
Design Philadelphia supports WHYY. Celebrating its 10th anniversary, the Design Philadelphia Festival takes place now through October 17th and showcases the work of 400 architects and designers. This Center for Architecture signature program is an opportunity to explore design in traditional and unexpected ways through 125 exhibits, workshops, demonstrations, tours, lectures, and events held in a variety of citywide venues. Events, tickets, and information are online at designphiladelphia.org.
Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley College's School of Graduate and Professional Studies. DelVal's graduate programs feature on-campus, online, and accelerated classes. With an emphasis on social justice, community development, global economy, policy shifts, trends in education, and career advance. An open house to learn about DelVal's master's and doctoral degrees will be held Thursday, October 23rd from 5 to 7 p.m. More at delval.edu/GPS open house.
Crozier Keystone's bariatric surgery program supports WHYY. Located in the heart of Delaware County, Crozier Keystone's comprehensive bariatric program provides a full surgical complement of advanced weight loss solutions to people throughout the region. Among them, a host of procedures that, in many cases, can be performed in a minimally invasive manner with the help of the Da Vinci robotic system. The Crozier Keystone Bariatric Surgery Program, over 1,000 procedures performed. More information at CrozierKeystone.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about a vision that some people in the city have of Philadelphia as a thriving energy hub, using the natural gas from Marcellus Shale, bringing it to the region and processing it along the Delaware River, the Schuylkill River as well. And as you can imagine, there are critics of this idea. We've been hearing from some of them who are worried and opposed to the idea of building an economy and infrastructure built around natural gas. But obviously, there are people on the other side as well. Talking with Patrick Kirkstra, who wrote about this in Philadelphia Magazine, and with Mark Allen Hughes, the city's first director of sustainability, now faculty director of the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Joining us now, and he's been listening in, is Mark Brownstein. He's associate vice president and chief counsel for the U.S. Climate and Energy Program at the Environmental Defense Fund. And Mark Brownstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We need to bring him up somehow. We will. Well, we'll figure out how to bring him up and then get him in on the conversation. Do we have you?
Yes, I'm here, Marty.
Okay,
Thank you. I've been listening attentively to the conversation. It's been quite good. Thank you.
So what is your takeaway? What do you think of this idea? Broadly speaking.
Well, I think it's on the one hand, it's understandable that a city like Philadelphia would look to the energy abundance to the west and try to figure out how to make the most of it for the local economy. And at the same time, as your guests have been discussing, there are some significant risks associated with doubling down on natural gas dependency. Both in terms of, where is this going to take us in the future, but also the very real risks that communities are currently facing as a consequence of development, risks to air, water quality, community quality, and ultimately the climate.
Well, and Mark Allen Hughes touched on this, but I want to expand on it with all three of you, actually. And going back to you, Mark Brownstein, the problem, the worry about methane and the release of methane as it relates to natural gas. What are your concerns?
Yeah, well, the methane issue is an incredibly important one. Obviously, we're very worried about impacts to water quality. That is a material impact to communities here and now. But when we talk about methane, what we're fundamentally concerned about is what is the impact of this gas development and use over the long term? Many people don't realize natural gas is methane,
right,
primarily, and methane is a powerful greenhouse gas pollutant, many times more powerful than carbon dioxide itself. Recent science indicates that up to 25% of the warming that we're experiencing today is the result of methane building up in the atmosphere. It doesn't last as long as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but for the time that it is in the atmosphere, it is very effective at trapping solar radiation and causing warming.
Well, let me go back to you, Mark Allen Hughes, and just say he was kind of underscoring the point that you were making as well. But if this is a vision for the future of Philadelphia and even the region and beyond, people are going to need certainty that this methane problem is going to be addressed.
they're going to need comfort, right, that it's going to be addressed, right? I wish we could have certainty. Certainty is too high a standard probably for anything, but they need comfort, right? And so, and this is where, this is why it's so important to involve people where they live, so to speak, literally and figuratively, around these concerns, right? Because they have to trust the process, especially around methane leakage, right? If we just focus, there's so many different things to talk about, right? But if we focus on this fugitive methane and the loss in the systems, make sure that as we double down is a perfectly good phrase, right? As we extend our investment, some of which is going to be public, right? Unavoidably public, either directly or indirectly, the investment in these infrastructures that are going to create profits for others, that we've got to have a policy regime around that that makes people feel comfortable about the real costs and who's bearing them.
I do want to go back to you, Mark. Let me give Patrick Kirkstar, looks like he wants to add something. Go ahead, Patrick.
Well, there already has been public investment, and it will continue. I mean, just to keep it local here in Philadelphia, you know, the saving, quote unquote, of the refineries, which were about to close, involved significant state funding there, you know, for uses such as the construction of a new rail unloader, which unloads those rail trains or oil trains, excuse me, that are coming into to feed the South Philadelphia refinery, and then the same for the old Conoco refinery in and Trainer. Mm. So there's already significant public money. And, yeah, Phil Rinaldi suggested that perhaps the state could be among the investors in his pipeline project.
But are political people rah-rah about this, or are they sort of putting their finger to the wind?
I think the folks that are involved are rah-rah, and I think that it's really only starting to gel as a real idea. So I think it's unlikely that the entire political class is rah-rah about something like this. I think it affects different constituencies in very different ways. But yes, some key Philadelphia political figures, Congressman Bob Brady, City Council President Daryl Clark, you know, are interested and more than interested in the project so far, and especially in the case of the congressman.
Mark, we were talking about this earlier, whether, you know, natural gas spells the death knell for coal, or whether it puts off investment in solar and wind and some of the renewables. How do you see the role playing, and how can it be improved so that it benefits us all?
Well, I think you have to tease out the fact that natural gas is increasingly important as a source of fuel for electricity, but two-thirds of the natural gas that we consume in the United States involves heating our homes, cooking our foods, and, as we've been talking about here, providing feedstock to industry. So, I think the first thing that we have to understand is we have to take a step back, understand the role that natural gas is playing in our energy economy overall, and realize that much as we would like to transition away from a fossil fuel future, and many of us are working to try to do that, there's a period of time where natural gas is going to be with us. And so it's incredibly important that we put emphasis both on policies that begin to wean us away from fossil fuel dependency, and at the same time keep our eye on the ball. What can we do to reduce environmental impacts for however long gas continues to be an important part of our energy economy. Specific to the generation of electricity, it's a little bit of a good news, bad news story. I mean, on the one hand, the cost of renewable energy has been coming down precipitously over the last several years. There are many parts of the country where new wind and even solar facilities can compete with new gas-fired generation at today's prices. That's not true everywhere, but it is true in some places. I think, too, that we need to look at how we're using the gas. Mark earlier mentioned some of the technologies that enable us to do distributed energy, which can make much more efficient use of the gas and thereby reduce the overall carbon footprint because you're getting more energy value out of every molecule that you use. I think we need to look at those technologies as well.
Yeah, and I'm seeing some nodding heads, especially from you, Mark Ellen Hughes.
Well, and, you know, what's nice about Mark's last point is that, you know, it flips density from being just a source, as Patrick is good at, you know, reminding us, it flips density from being a concern, right? Unsafe technologies, leaking infrastructures, and so on, fix that, and then suddenly density becomes your friend for distributed forms of using this energy in a much more efficient way.
Go ahead, Mark.
But, you know, Marty, again, the point was made earlier, and it's important to underscore, right? I think the biggest threat here is sort of public policy attention deficit disorder. Where you get so dazzled by the current abundance of natural gas that you sort of lose sight of the importance of investing in these newer technologies and incentivizing these technologies. You know, I'm calling you from New Jersey. We continue to invest in solar here in our state. I would hope that as Pennsylvania moves forward, that there continues to be an emphasis on ramping up programs that incentivize things like wind development and solar development and some of these other technologies we've been talking about.
Yeah, go ahead.
So that's a great point. Let me just extend that. That now is the time to negotiate in the policy development sense. Now is the time to negotiate that. You want public investment in a pipeline or another piece of infrastructure? Then we are going to create the conditions under which we take really seriously this pivot towards more efficient and renewable sources of power. And now is the time to do that, right? We're gonna change our it's called in Pennsylvania, it's called an alternative, our renewable portfolio standard for where we get our energy from to be much more favorable to these kinds of emerging and renewable technologies as a condition, and I mean that very literally, as a condition of certain kinds of infrastructure and other kinds of investments for natural gas.
Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Brian calling us from Center City, Philadelphia, Executive Director of the Keystone Energy Alliance. Brian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
Sure.
Great to be listening in on this conversation.
Yeah, what are your
so
thoughts?
Important right now. Well, our organization, it works for energy efficiency companies based around Pennsylvania. And as we're talking about here, a thriving hub, and I'd say in a lot of ways we already have a thriving hub for energy efficiency in buildings. We have over 60 companies working in that space. And just concerned that this discussion is, as we're talking about, focused on natural gas and a bit myopic, looking at supply, but not really thinking about demand and all that we can accomplish on reducing our bills, energy bills, particularly around the demand side.
Well, fair enough. Brian, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Actually, Mark, let me toss that to you and the efficiency part of this conversation, which is just making our use of energy much more efficient.
Well, and in some ways, Marty, the whole focus on methane, I would argue, has an efficiency component to it, right? State Impact Pennsylvania did a report earlier this year that talked about the amount of natural gas that leaks from the Philadelphia Gas Works system.
That's right.
Okay. That is methane that goes right up into the atmosphere and, as we said, is a pernicious greenhouse gas. When we take steps to reduce that leakage, invest in the existing infrastructure to make it tighter, right, we're not only doing something for the environment, frankly, we're doing something for the economy as well, because that's gas that is otherwise going to waste. I fully agree with your last caller, though, that energy efficiency has to remain at the top of the list. You know, whether we're talking about new gas-fired generation or new solar generation or new wind generation, our first steps should be to make much more efficient use of energy in our homes and businesses and industries.
And let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's Mark Brownstein from the Environmental Defense Fund. Also with us, Patrick Kirkstra, who has a piece in this month's edition of Philadelphia Magazine, and Mark Allen Hughes. Also with us, Faculty Director of the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Patrick, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I think efficiency is important. In fact, you know, Phil Rinaldi is interested in a gas-fired plant at his facility in order to improve the efficiency of his plant. But, you know, we're talking about the chief vision here for this plant is an industrial use, right? And these guys are going to use a ton of gas. I mean, we're talking about stuff like making steel, which is an incredibly energy-intensive process.
Yeah.
Cement, incredibly energy-intensive. Using the gas as a feedstock. So efficiency is great. I think efficiency ought to be pursued. But we're really talking about the industrial use here. And that's what they conceive as driving this demand, not increased residential use. Industrial use.
Mentioned PGW. We've done hours of shows about that. How does PGW fit into this, Philadelphia Gas Works, or does it yet?
Oh, well, not yet, but I mean, it might. It's a real wild card in all of this. You will hear folks who are behind this vision of an energy hub argue that it's imperative that PGW be privatized in order for this vision to become a reality. Because a private company will be able to bring more capital into the rebuilding of the infrastructure of the PGW infrastructure, they'll be more nimble. They'll be able to take better advantage of the sort of business opportunities that would be available to a PGW if this new pipeline were built. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, you've got concerns that this emerging opportunity hasn't really been baked into the cost, and that. If we sell for what we're trying to sell for now, that, the city would be leaving a lot of money on the table. If this utility were publicly owned going forward, that it could make a heck of a lot of money. Mm. There's good arguments on both sides of that one.
Yeah, and about a minute to go. Mark, you talk about the fact that, we need to be front and center on this and get all the stakeholders together. You've worked for government here in Philadelphia. Do you feel optimistic that this is an issue that can be both reasonably and rationally discussed and some kind of consensus?
I've lived in Philadelphia long enough to where I wouldn't necessarily call myself optimistic. But what I would say is that one source of optimism is that I do believe that there's an opportunity to do a big deal here because there are enough forces that could prevent it from happening that promoters of this strategy are going to be, they're going to be willing to sit at a table. It's government is actually going to be the one that needs to set up, but it's going to be easier for government to step on this than I think we might expect.
And Mark, we're almost out of time. Is this something that's being watched by other cities, other communities, what may or may not happen in Philadelphia in terms of being an energy hub?
There's no question that people are looking at Philadelphia and Pennsylvania as the ghost of Christmas future, and it's all the more reason why both in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, it's critically important that we get this right, that we have the right regulations in place, that they're strictly enforced, and that we don't allow methane to just escape into the atmosphere. Otherwise, the public will have no confidence that we can that we can use this resource in a way that's responsible.
Well, I appreciate all three of you joining us today in Radio Times. Mark Brownstein, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Mark, Patrick Kirkstra, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Mark Allen Hughes, thanks a lot for joining us as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, and Quinn Libson, our intern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.